afternoon, everybody. How is it going out there? My name is Amy, and I am here at WMRW, live in the studio in Warren, Vermont, to bring you the 4-H show. It is my pleasure to bring you the 4-H show, which stands for Harmony. I'm sorry. Health, Harmony, Happiness, and Humor. And I have a special guest today. She is on her way to the studio. In fact, I think I see her outside the door right now. I'm going to wave to her. Hold on 1 second, folks. Come on in. Perfect timing, Betsy. Come on in. I'm just going to do a little bit of business here while you get settled in. Yeah, and let folks know that you are listening to WMRW at 94.5 FM. WMRW LP, which I just learned today from the previous programmer, stands for Low Power FM. So we are a community radio station out of Warren, Vermont. You can also find us on WMRW.org. And just so you know, the following program presents the views of its participants and producers. It does not necessarily represent the views of WMRW or its license holder, RootsWork. And we are partly underwritten by a few sponsors. We have Super Simple Foods, offering homemade soups and fresh bread daily. You can find Super Simple Foods at the Mad River Car Wash at 124 Findlers Green in Waitsfield, Wednesday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. We are also partly underwritten by Whippletree Designs, and they have Vermont souvenir apparel for all ages. Whippletree Designs is located at the Mad River Green Shopping Center in Waitsfield. You can reach Whippletree Designs by calling 802-496-9694 and follow them on Instagram under Whippletree Designs. So we're going to put on just a little bit of music, an appropriate song called Breathe, before I bring on our guest as we get settled in here to hear from Betsy Thomason today. I'm so excited that she made the trip here to Warren. We're going to have a lovely conversation, so I'll join you in a moment. Thanks for joining us.
Just breathe. Thank you.
Folks, thank you for joining us. This is Amy at the 4-H Show, and I have here live in the studio Betsy Thomason, who is also known as the Revolutionary Respiratory Therapist and Breathing Trainer. She is the director of the Out Breath Institute and author of Just Breathe Out, which is a book that was published in, I think, 2016 or 2017. Oh, fantastic. You brought a copy because I was going to ask you where we can find them. Yeah. As well as author of several articles that I've seen published around when I was researching you, Betsy. And I'm so glad that you made the trip so that we can get some really good health advice on how to take care of ourselves.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Oh, let's just make sure.
There we go.
There
okay,
we go.
Good.
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah, it's a beautiful drive up from Townsend. Beautiful day. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so you called me the Revolutionary Respiratory Therapist. You know, I have RRT after my name. 30 years ago, I thought I needed some medical alphabet after my name. I was a breathing trainer first, and then I decided that I should go back to school, and I thought that respiratory therapists, it sounded like they knew all about breathing. They know about keeping airways open and breathing machines, devices, and things. And they do great work. I mean, I'm a respiratory therapist. I've done that kind of work in an ICU. But I realized that they don't know a lot about how to breathe. Mm. And I call myself, so I have an RRT after my name, Registered Respiratory Therapist. But for me, it's revolutionary because I have dared to change the definition of breathing from sucking air in to blowing it out. And, you know, revolutionaries, we have a tough road because we get maligned. And my Respiratory Professional Association would not support promoting my book.
Really?
Yeah, really. So that's why I'm revolutionary, because, you know, we step on fragile territory.
Right. When we're discussing health and healing, it seems like a lot of the institutions are maybe not aiming that way for some reason, that when we try to come along with truth and just basic principles, we meet a lot of opposition or censorship or...
Yeah, because really medicine is about medicine, i.e. drugs.
Mm.
And I realized, I went through the two-year training. At the time, it was 2 years. Nowadays, you need to get a bachelor's degree in respiratory therapy. All respiratory therapists, for the last maybe 4 or 5 years, have had to have a bachelor's degree. Prior to that, it was an associate's degree, or even less.
Oh, wow.
18 months. I decided to go for the two-year community college degree back in early 1990s. I did this training. I I'm grateful that I did it because I learned so much. I didn't know what I was going to learn. I literally had no idea that I'd be learning how to put tubes down people's throats to suction them, or I tried, intubation was just not for me. And it was something that respiratory therapists didn't have to do, but we were taught how to do it and we had to try it. We also had to do needle sticks in the arm to get arterial blood. And it's different than a nurse taking, you know, a blood sample for testing. She goes into a vein, vein. Veins are through which blood returns to the heart. Arteries are the vessels through which blood travels, going away from the heart, so full of oxygen into the tissue. And as a respiratory therapist, I had to take arterial blood from an artery in the wrist, which is not something you can see, it's something you feel. So you're sticking a needle not into some place that you visualize, but some place that you feel with your finger. I had no idea what I was getting into when I went to respiratory school. And I wasn't the best student until the professor said, you know, you have to stop standing in the back of the room and you've got to participate and do this if you want to get pass the exams, pass the licensure test, and get licensed. You've got to do all this. And so I just had a real serious talk with myself, and I decided that I was going to use my knowledge of breathing to relax myself when I was doing these needle sticks, and also to help my patients relax, because if a patient isn't relaxed, you're not going to find their artery very easily, and it's going to hurt. And my goal was to never hurt anyone. So I would say to this person, okay, I want you to pretend you're blowing up a balloon, or that you're blowing on a pinwheel, something to get them to focus on their out-breath, because remember, I'm the revolutionary respiratory therapist. It's about out-breath, not sucking air in. So they would be focused on their out-breath. I would also be focused on my out-breath to keep me relaxed, keep my fingers shaking, you know, to do a really neat and tidy job of getting their little bit of arterial blood. And it helped me greatly to know how to breathe effectively, to be a better respiratory therapist. So that's my story of becoming a respiratory therapist.
Oh, fantastic. And so it helped you calm down and stay grounded.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Even right now, after losing my way a little bit and having trouble finding the studio, to remain calm and confident, your out-breath is the root.
So it affects not just our physical pain or suffering or comfort, but our psychological.
Absolutely.
As well. Yeah. So what led you? How did you discover the out-breath and the importance of it?
You know, I have believed that to find your way in the world, you need to just follow the path that you're on, whatever it is. And basically, that path is discovered by asking yourself, what do I love to do? What really makes me happy? And if you pay attention to that and let your heart speak to you, and not let anyone discourage you from following your heart. Oh, it's not making money, or really? You think you can do that? don't buy into that. Go with what your heart says. And, you know, I decided that I was in my 40s when I went back to school, mid to late 40s. And I decided that I could survive in this world. I would do anything. I had housekeeping jobs. I gardened for somebody to put bread on the table. That's all I need, is put bread on the table, pay the basic stuff. But if I'm going to pursue what I love, I have to be willing to sacrifice not having the lifestyle that, you know, might be appropriate for my whatever,
right.
You know.
Right.
So there are some sacrifices, but in the long run, it makes you so happy. And so I was following my path, which is being outdoors, hiking. I started a group called Adventures for Women. It was in New Jersey because I learned so much from being outdoors. I learned so much about myself as a strong woman, having to, in some cases, push my way into situations to share my knowledge because I wasn't being asked what I could contribute to a situation. And so, but I learned that from the outdoors, being strong, observing myself as a strong woman. And I decided that I wanted to help other women to be strong like that too, from the outdoors. And so I taught map and compass. I taught canoeing skills, cross-country skiing skills to women. And I didn't make a lot of money, but you know what? It led me on this path. And on that path, I met a woman who was an occupational therapist. Her name was Ann Mavril Mattis. She taught us how to get up mountains without huffing and puffing. She taught us a little Tai Chi. She taught us a little yoga. And she taught us a system called the Breathe Out Dynamic System, which was developed by an Olympic trainer named Ian Jackson. Well, I learned this as best I could, and in 1986, Anne was dying of breast cancer. And she asked me, at that time I was an elementary school teacher, a wilderness guide, but she asked me to continue her work teaching breathing. And I was like, oh my goodness, what a gift. How can I refuse this gift? But I had no idea what it meant. Hmm. But I agreed to do this for her.
Oh, wow.
And Ann did die about a year later. And it gave me time to think about what I wanted to do. And she gave me her notebooks with all her lesson plans and things and information that she'd gathered. But I still didn't know how to make it my own. So after talking to a number of people, I decided I really needed to go back to school. And somebody I questioned suggested respiratory therapy. So I called the local community college. I had a little tour at the local hospital to see what respiratory therapists do. Did I understand what they do when I started? Absolutely not.
How exciting.
Yeah, really, really. I can tell you that I'm grateful I knew how to breathe effectively because it was the most stressful 2 years of my education and the best education I could say that I got. Even going to college, I was never challenged the way I was physically, emotionally, spiritually challenged by respiratory therapy.
And I don't know where I found this quote of yours, but you said something somewhere in one of your articles, I think, about how you are most secure with insecurities.
Yeah.
And so that sounds like your ability, like with whitewater rafting, to lean into discomfort, or in that classroom, to lean into and follow those things that might feel scary.
Yeah. You know, the world is not a safe place.
Ding, 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 ding.
You know, whether we like it or not, we are faced with insecurity all the time. So why not have a game plan?
Yeah.
To deal with it?
Yeah, some practice, you know, some experience with it under our belt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good for you. Yeah. So you leaned into respiratory therapy.
Yeah. And so then I thought to myself, well, you know, you don't really want to be a respiratory therapist. But if you are going to call yourself a respiratory therapist and have this RRT business after your name, you need experience. So I forced myself into what I called an internship. For 2 years, mm-hmm. I worked in an ICU, okay. An intensive care unit at a local hospital. It was the hardest work, demanding. It was, yeah. But I had to do it. I didn't know what I was going to learn, but when I learned it, I knew it, and it was about 2 years into the experience in the ICU that I had a patient who was intubated. That means she had a tube in her throat attached to a ventilator. And she was my patient. That meant I was in charge of her ventilator. I had to check it periodically to make sure that the settings were still appropriate, that the machine was working the way it was supposed to work, the patient was comfortable. And I was standing at the door of her room, and I could hear the machine cycling. Now, a breathing machine is set for a certain breathing rate. Let's say 15 breaths a minute. It's kind of a moderate breathing rate, a healthy breathing rate. But I could tell this machine was going ding, ding, ding. It was just sending breaths in, like 30 breaths a minute. So I knew that this person was anxious. And I thought to myself, how can I help her? What can I do? And the thought ran through my head, you're an inexperienced respiratory therapist. What are you going to do for this woman? And I had to tap myself on the shoulder and say, stop thinking that way. You are her respiratory therapist. Do something. Go in there. I had not a clue as what I was going to do. But, you know, when you go into the ICU room, there are monitors that record blood pressure, oxygen saturation, and blood pressures at several different places throughout your body. So it's not just the blood pressure like you get from a blood pressure cuff, but people who are intubated often have tubes in their airway that measure pressures at different places in their body. So I could tell this woman was just, you know, she was, her body was out of control. And without much thought, I went over to her, introduced myself, and said, you want to play a little game with me? Now, this is a person who can't talk. So she indicates with a smile or blinks her eyes or whatever she does. And I asked her if she had a good imagination, and she said she did. And I said, I want you to pretend you're blowing up a balloon. Ah. And so she did that. And very shortly, that machine started giving her only 15 breaths a minute. So the noise changed. The sound of the machine changed from the bump, 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 bump of 30 breaths a minute to bump, bump, bump.
So it settled down.
Because I didn't know how this worked or how to explain it, but she became relaxed. Her body just went into relaxation mode. And what I learned from that, I learned so much from her, that when you are connected to a ventilator, and a lot of people in our 21st century, third decade, actually we're into the third decade, know what a ventilator is. Mm-hmm. When you are connected to a ventilator, you are doing a dance, really, with that. You are part of a circuit. It's not just this machine doing something for you. It's that you have a relationship with this ventilator. You can affect it, as this woman showed me. She could change that ventilator by her anxiousness. She changed it to delivering more breaths, which she didn't need. They were not helpful breaths at all.
Oh.
But what people think is when I'm on a ventilator, oh, the machine's doing all the work, I don't have to do anything. Wrong. Your job is to be relaxed. How do you relax? Well, there are certainly drugs. We know about drugs that relax you. But the breathe out dynamic system is about drug-free management of anxiety, fear, pain, and stress.
Wow.
And we have the power to do this if we only know about it.
All right.
Yeah.
So tell us more about this. Breathe out dynamic.
So I went to school. I did my internship. And when I told the doctor so excitedly about what I had discovered, he looked at me as if I was nuts.
Oh.
Denying that what I asked her to do had any significance at all.
Wow.
And I knew from my study with Ian Jackson, the guy who developed the breathe out dynamic system, that you indeed affect your nervous system. But I couldn't articulate it to this MD who had all the answers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided, you know, I think my 2 years are up. it's time for me to leave and move on. And I actually got my preferred job, which was teaching people to breathe in a pulmonary rehabilitation program. Mm. I became an exercise instructor. I taught people how to breathe and to use the their out-breath to support their physical activity. And these were mostly old ex-smokers.
Oh.
Some of them had, one guy had fibrosis from a workplace injury. So the varying reasons why people are in pulmonary rehab, but many are ex-smokers, hopefully ex-smokers. But you know what, also, this was in the 90s, in the mid-90s. It was a hospital-based program, and it was in a gym that was set up for cardiac patients. And pulmonary got a corner. We had our little corner because, of course, lungs are not as important as heart.
Well,
yeah.
How does one work without the other?
Yeah, right, exactly. But we were the stepchild. You know, we were not there 5 days a week. We were there 2 days a week. Uh-huh. And, of course, the heart patients did not need to learn how to breathe effectively. Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, no.
This we're compartmentalizing
just,
here.
Yeah, we are, yeah. Absolutely. So that job lasted a while. Uh-huh. And actually, after I left that job, I decided that I signed off of hospitals. It was just not the way I wanted to go. And I decided not to get a job right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how revolutionary.
I know. I said, you know what? You're just going to chill and see what happens. And a year went by. And I still was just, I was doing some writing, you know, making a few pennies here and there. But, you know, living off, I had $25,000 of savings. And I said, you know what? That'll last me at least a year. I can sneak by on that. Mm-hmm. And let's see what happens. Well, a year and a half went by. And my sister said, hey, would you like a free trip to China?
Ooh.
And I said, you know, that sounds great. But I said to myself, you know what? And this was like, she was asking me to go in a month because somebody had backed out of a trip she was organizing. I said, you have to have a job before you go. So I thought about, who do I know? And I made a couple of phone calls, and I connected with a woman. Her name is Mary Ellen Downey. She was became my employer for 15 or more years in a respiratory home care company. Oh. Not just helping people with oxygen, but helping people with ventilation at home. People who had muscular dystrophy or had polio as a child and whose lungs were not working as well as they could be. Some of these people still worked full time.
Wow.
But they slept with a mechanical ventilator. Wow. Nobody would know this because the ventilator energized them. They got good sleep because they were breathing well at night with this machine. Mm-hmm. Which is not a CPAP or a BiPAP. It's a ventilator. And these were simple machines, basic machines, which I loved because machines were starting to get digital and very complex with all kinds of waveforms of what your lungs are doing. And it was just way beyond me. So these basic ventilators were perfect for me. When I accepted this job, I really had no idea what I was getting into.
Once again.
Once again. But it was the perfect job for me. In fact, I told Mary Ellen when I took the job, I'll be here a couple of years and I'll be moving on because that had been my MO. You know, take a job, see what you can learn, and then move on. Well, I was there for over 15 years.
How come?
Yeah. How come? Because Mary Ellen created Millennium Respiratory Services, which is a heartfelt company, a lung-felt company that helps people who want to stay alive and thrive, but need some support. And I've been retired from Millennium for 6 years, and I still speak of it as if I work there. We help people to thrive with compassion. And I traveled I was licensed in 6 states. I traveled all over the place helping people with mechanical ventilation. Excellent. Yeah, it was an awesome time.
And bringing, I would imagine, the out-breath. Where did you bring that into your work? Do you bring that
you
into
know, so, Millennium thinks outside the box, continues to think outside the box. They're located in New Jersey, have an office in Florida, and I wish there were more Millenniums around. But at any rate, Millennium, I lost my train of thought here.
Have you been teaching out-breath?
Oh, yes. So, mm-hmm. I was a new employee. Mary Ellen asked me if I would like one day a week to work at an ALS clinic in Manhattan, in New York City, as the staff respiratory therapist. I thought, great. I didn't think about it as a hospital because this was an outpatient kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. So I said, sure. So when I went there, of course, my job was to evaluate patients, to do breathing tests, which sounds simple and basic, and it is, but when it's for a group of people who modern medicine feel are on the slippery slope towards death, and you're measuring their capacity to breathe, you often don't have good news for them. So it wasn't a particularly uplifting job. And I decided that there was no way that I could not teach them the breathe-out dynamic system. And when I told the supervisors what I was doing, they said, oh, no, your job is... you know, to measure their vital capacity. And I thought to myself, yeah, really? That's what you think? And I thought to myself, so I have 20 minutes to see a patient. I need to find a way to teach this as simply, basically, and instantly as I possibly can. Mm-hmm. So I came up with this idea that your pointer finger is really a pinwheel. And I would say this to a person usually sitting in a wheelchair, I want you to pretend that this is a pinwheel. I want you to keep it spinning comfortably. And when you can no longer blow out comfortably, pause and then get right back to blowing out. Blow out, pause, blow out. And I would watch them do this.
I'm doing it right now.
And as I watched them, I noticed their bellies. Mm. When they were blowing out, their belly was crunched. It was going, the belly button was going towards their spine. And when they paused, their belly came out a little bit. And it just kept doing this. The belly would go in for the out-breath, and for the pause, the belly would come out. And what I discovered was that these people, many of whom had paralysis, severe paralysis, they couldn't move their hands, their arms, their legs, they were in wheelchairs, but their belly muscles still worked.
Wow.
In their subconscious, you know, I didn't tell them what to do with their belly. Their belly knew what to do. Mm. So this was a big wake-up call for me, but it also made it very simple for me to teach everybody. So yes, there was no way I could not teach this. This is my mission in life, is to share this, and that's why I'm here at the radio station today, because the world needs to know about the power of the out-breath.
Mm. Yeah, so you've been teaching your clients. You've also written a book called Just Breathe Out.
Yeah.
Where can people find this book, Just Breathe Out?
Well, you know, I do have a website, outbreathinstitute.com, where you can order it. But you know what I really like? I like people to go to their local bookstore and ask the bookseller to order it through their local distribution. I did self-publish this book, but I paid a lot of money to have this book available through normal distribution channels. I felt it was very important for it to be available in bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get it in your bookstore. And I also like people to ask their local librarian to order it.
Yes.
Now, it was published 6 years ago, but it's still available. And it is a classic, I want to tell you. It is a How to Breathe guidebook. James Nestor has written a book called Breathe. It has a beautifully yellow cover. I can see it in my mind's eye. And it's a bestseller. But when I was looking for a publisher, let's say 10 years ago, because it does take time to find a publisher, nobody wanted to touch breathing.
Really?
Yeah, really. I know.
Wow.
It's amazing. So I just said, okay, I'm going to publish this book myself. It must look like a book that some publisher published, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And therefore, it must be available through local distribution channels. The book is also in Nook and Kindle versions.
Okay.
I recorded it in iTunes Audible.
Great.
Yes.
With you reading it.
With me reading it.
Fantastic.
And this is a lovely link. It is also published by the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress has what's called the National Library Service. It's a service for people who are not able to read a regular book. Either they're blind or have low vision, or they cannot use their hands to hold a book. So Just Breathe Out is published by the National Library Service in audio. They recorded it themselves, and in Braille.
Oh, fantastic.
And the way I got that accomplished, you know, it's all in who you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know people. You know, it's not just, I'm not the only one, or people who publish books or have radio shows aren't the only people who know somebody. Everybody knows somebody. And we all have to get more comfortable in sharing our desires, you know? So
yeah.
In 2000, I decided I needed to be more social, personally. And so I joined a ski club. But it was a downhill ski club. I wasn't really a downhill skier, but cross-country ski clubs were few and far between. So I joined a downhill ski club. And I downhill skied, but anyway, the best people in this downhill ski club were cross-country skiers. And one of them told me about this organization called Ski for Light, L-I-G-H-T, Ski for Light. It's a Norwegian-American, shall we say, organization that helps blind people to cross-country ski.
Wow.
Yeah. So in 2000, I think, was the first year I attended a week of skiing in Colorado, I believe it was, where I was a guide for a blind skier. I had to learn how to be a guide for blind skiers. One of the skiers I met worked at the Library of Congress.
There you go. Yeah. Isn't it through serving others, too, I found? You know, facing our fears and pushing into that discomfort. But also through service. You know, when we care about others and go out of our way to help, it always comes back, like tenfold.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I know. So, and I'm so proud. Judy told me that many people had asked her to query the Library of Congress to publish her book, their books, and mine was the first that she ever accomplished that.
Wow.
So, yeah, I'm so proud to have it in the Library of Congress, yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I do encourage people to track down this book, Just Breathe Out.
Mm.
And you also have several articles that were published in your local paper, The Commons, and maybe elsewhere. I think I found a couple in other publications,
yes,
too.
I've written op-ed pieces for The Commons, and also I now have two articles published by the Weston Price Foundation in their quarterly journal called Wise Traditions. The first one was about why mechanical ventilation did not work in COVID.
Oh.
And the simple answer is that COVID was a problem of iron metabolism in the blood. If you have low hemoglobin, you can add all the oxygen you want to your body and it's going to do no good, because the hemoglobin is the molecule that carries oxygen. no hemoglobin. The oxygen has nothing to jump onto. So we were ventilating people, and it was going nowhere.
Wow.
So that was the first article. And then the second one, I thought of all the techniques I learned as a respiratory therapist, some of which I use on myself. One of them is clapping. So you cup your hand, you put your fingers together and you cup your hand and you clap. Wherever you have ribs, you have lungs. And you can really bang on your chest. I mean, your body is a strong body. And this is a way of loosening mucus. So when you have a wicked bad cold or you have pneumonia, you want to clap your lungs. Now, this is something we did routinely in the hospital. When I was learning respiratory therapy, there were no machines that could do this. Now there are machines. So you could put on a vest, I know.
Oh, jeez.
You could put on a vest that is connected with a tube to a machine that generates a pulse and basically shakes you. Which is good in a way, but the hands-on is so important. So I thought I knew all these little techniques that are used in hospitals often, but the general public doesn't know them in terms of how to maintain your health so that you don't go to the hospital. So I wrote a second article about all the techniques that people can use, everything from cleaning out your nose with normal saline to clapping your lungs and when you have a cold, and postural drainage and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm going to write now another article for Weston Price about asthma, because asthma is another, well, the word bogus comes to mind. It's not bogus. Just like COVID is not bogus. What's bogus is how we get it. We're not fessing up about the real cause of these things. Mm-hmm. So what my message to people with asthma is, first of all, learn the breathe-out dynamic system. And by the way, if you go on my website, outbreathinstitute.com, you will have access to a lot of learning materials, including a YouTube video. It's a 10-minute video. It replicates chapter 3 of the book, which is the how to breathe, how to do the breathe-out dynamic system. You need to learn that. And once again, I lost my train of thought. We were talking about, asthma. Okay, asthma, right. So what I say to people with asthma is, before you ever take your rescue inhaler, which is usually albuterol, it's a puffer. You've seen these things. In fact, if you put your thumb and your index finger about 4 inches apart, that's kind of the moniker, is that the right word?
Oh, yeah.
To suggest that, you have asthma, you must use an inhaler, and you pump your fingers a little. Any rate, people know what this is, especially kids. There are a lot of kids who use inhalers. But
yes.
Anyway,
yes.
My message to people who use inhalers is, before you ever use your rescue inhaler, which means you're using it in between a regular dose, is that you sit down, you focus on your out-breath for at least 15 minutes and see if your symptoms go away.
Wow.
And most often they go away and you don't need the rescue inhaler. So,
Yeah. Wow. So, and this is really excellent for us here on the 4-H show to be getting into some health and healing techniques that we can use for ourselves to empower ourselves. Because a lot of the medical narrative is, you're hopeless, you're helpless, just take this stuff, put on this device, do this, and that's going
to
save
you. How long do I have to use this? Oh, the rest of my life. No.
That's not a good answer.
No. And I love the 4 H's. And the H I really love? Humor.
Mm.
And that fits in so beautifully here. There was a guy who lived in the previous century. His name was Norman Cousins. He wrote a book called...
That name sounds familiar.
He was a journalist, a political journalist, but he was, I'm trying to think of the name of the book. He was diagnosed with some, I think it was, cancer, I think, and given a death sentence. And he said, no,
no,
no, this is not happening. And he laughed himself back to health.
Yeah.
He got all the funny movies he could get, and he got himself out of the hospital. He went home, and he just laughed all the time. Yeah. And in his book, he doesn't tell, Norman Cousins doesn't say why he thinks he was able to heal himself, but I know why.
I know why, listening to you.
Yeah, laughter is your out breath.
Ah.
Yeah.
An expressive out breath.
Yes.
Like singing. You did a nice interview with this music teacher
yeah.
that people can find on YouTube with Lori. It was great.
Uh-huh.
Because she knew just about it from teaching music and singing.
Yeah. Yeah. So your out breath is so powerful. So humor. Humor is essential. And, you know, if you don't have a funny bone yet, you can grow one. It's possible.
It's never too late.
No, it's correct. That is correct.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So humor, well, health, of course. Now, there's health and there's well-being. Health is kind of like, you know, you go to the doctor and you get a clean bill of health.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say you don't get a clean bill of health.
Mm-hmm.
There's something called well-being. And it has to do with a belief in self, in a belief in doing everything possible for yourself, and maybe even declining some thoughts of other people who think that they know how the road is going to go for you, you know?
Mm.
So well-being is about deciding that your spirit is uplifted. And you're going to find ways to uplift it, maybe by listening to music or watching funny movies or mm-hmm. or inspiring movies or whatever. That's well-being. And everyone can have well-being. Now, I feel humbled because I needed some humbling, actually.
We all do.
Yeah, I know. 30 years ago, I was bitten by a Lyme tick, and I had a week of doxycycline, the antibiotic, and I seemed to be home free. And then about 10 years ago, I started feeling a sensation in my left hip, and the doctors didn't know what that could be. Anyway, fast forward to about 4 years ago, and I was really having hip pain, and my chiropractor said, you know, you ought to go to the hospital and get yourself an x-ray and let's see what's going on in that hip. And lo and behold, I have no cartilage in my left hip. And
wow.
I'm thinking, how is that possible? I eat well, I exercise, I do all these things, and I have no cartilage in my hip. And then through reading stuff, not from really talking to any medical professional, I understood that Lyme tick was still in my body. The antibiotic, yeah, it sent it into hiding for 20 years in my gut. And then that little thing, when a person is under stress, these things surface.
Mm-hmm.
And this Lyme tick was eating, well, not the tick, but the bacteria. All the bugs that are associated with that Lyme tick were eating soft tissue in my body, and they happened to hone in on my cartilage. Now, other people, they have heart issues because mm-hmm. soft tissue, or they have brain fog, soft tissue. So I decided, though, that I was not a candidate for a hip replacement. Although my chiropractor urged me to, I said, nah, I don't do replacement parts. I'm going to work on this. And it was cavalier and flippant and whatnot, but it was what I wanted to do. And what I've realized in thinking this through is that it was a good idea, because if I had a hip replacement and didn't take care of the Lyme bug could go to my other hip. Or it could go to someplace else. And I've heard that people with Lyme-related hip issues, they don't do well with hip replacements. So let's say your body rejects the hip replacement. What do you do then?
Oh, my gosh.
Your hip has been basically destroyed so that you could have this metal part screwed in. but it doesn't work. So I'm saying to myself, you know, I think that wasn't so flippant. Mm-hmm. You know, so what I'm doing now actually is magnet therapy, because I've tried everything. I've tried herbs. And actually, I was bitten again 3 years ago. Again, I had initially had antibiotics, and it seemed to be okay. But now, herbs don't work. The tinctures don't work. So I'm doing magnet therapy, which buys into the notion that we are electric beings.
Mm.
Yeah. So I go every 2, 3, 4 weeks, and the therapist lays magnets on my body. I mean, it's like armor coating on your body for a half an hour, and the movement of electrons and protons and neutrons, whatever, riles up these bugs, and then you have to eliminate them, and it's a hard process, and it's debilitating. I have to work constantly at exercise to keep my hip joint mobile. I walk an hour a day. I stretch at least a half an hour every day to heal this hip, and it's going to take time. It may be another year or two working on this to get it functional. But I mean, it is functional to get it, but to get it fully functional. If I didn't know the breathe out dynamic system, if I didn't have this practice, if I didn't have the belief in my body, and you know, it really is about belief in body, it's about love for body. You must have no doubts that you have the best possible body. Your body is beautiful. You know, when something goes wrong, it's a message. It's not that your body is doing bad things. No, your body is just giving you a message, and you have to read the message.
And love the message, and love the body.
Unconditionally. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. You have the best possible body. The reason it's the best possible body is because you're actually on Earth. Without that body, you would not be represented here on Earth.
Right. It's our vehicle. It's our home.
Exactly. It's why I know you, Amy, because I can see you.
Mm-hmm.
And I can touch you.
Yeah. And I can be me. I can be in my body. And nothing does that better than breath. You know, being aware of the breathing.
Ooh. Yeah. So total unconditional love for your body is essential. And when you start learning the breathe out dynamic system, your body's going to work much better, because the out breath promotes relaxation. It gives you strength. So the relaxation part is huge, because it gives you back energy that you would have spent worrying or, you know, walking backwards or whatever, you know.
Right.
You know, so.
Right, holding your breath.
Yeah.
Tensing your rib cage.
Right, yeah. Holding your breath is such a bad idea.
It is.
But we all catch ourselves doing it. So when you catch yourself doing it, say, okay, I get it, I'm stressed. And so then just blow on your imaginary pinwheel.
Oh, I love the pinwheel.
Yeah, and get back to whatever you were doing.
Fantastic. Let me remind folks that it is the top of the hour. It's 1 o'clock. You're listening to WMRWLP at 94.5 FM, also found at WMRW.org online. And I am speaking right now live in the studio with Betsy Thomason, the revolutionary respiratory therapist and breathing trainer, director of the Outbreath Institute, and author of Just Breathe Out. And we have been talking about the importance of breathing. We've been talking about trusting our bodies and the amazing systems that we have, you know, and for me, breath is primary. So I am so glad to have you on here, because I have been celebrating breathing myself. People might know out there, or maybe not, but I have been celebrating breathing for the last few years in response to these mask mandates.
Well, and you are also a health coach.
Health teacher.
Yeah.
Health educator.
Yes.
Right? And so I teach people of all ages about their bodies and how to take care of them and what is healthy. And breath is so primary. I have learned so much over the last few years about the importance of breathing. And one of your op-ed articles was about masks.
Yes.
And you did write, you were very courageous because one thing I know you mentioned is you want to make a dedication for this show.
Oh, yes, yes.
Maybe we should mention that now and why before we launch into this other part of the discussion.
Yes. Julian Assange, we shout out to you in your prison cell in England. And I mention this because I learned on the news today that the Prime Minister of Australia, Julian's home country, is petitioning President Biden to give up his...
rendition? What is it? Oh, extradition?
Extradition.
I forget the word.
Of this journalist who 10 years ago revealed information that was...
It was information we should know.
It was information we should know. And we can see in the last 10 years, it hasn't caused any problem whatsoever. So let this man, this journalist, who's doing his job, bringing information to the people, set him free. Mm-hmm. So we send a shout out and prayer to Julian Assange.
Yeah, and in one of you also wrote an op-ed called "A Different Sort of Fascism," which and if I can just read a quote of yours right here, this is what you wrote. So what happens when the thinkers, the writers, and the artists are silenced because they do not conform to government standards? Who is going to ask the hard questions and demand accountability? Will you be on board to halt this descent into fascism? I just think that's it. You know, it takes such courage to speak out. And when I first met you and you mentioned you had been to a select board meeting and you had written this op-ed article about masks and the hazards, and here you are, a respiratory therapist, I just had to come and ask you more about this because I need some professional backup and advice here because so many medical professionals are afraid to speak out.
I know. And I say to myself, you know, if not you, who? I'm a respiratory therapist. I didn't see other respiratory therapists speaking out. And so I just had to, you know, buckle down and do it. And I had to, it did get published, my op-ed piece about masks did get published in the Commons, but I had to press the editor because he had already published an article. It was really kind of a silly article by a man who lived through World War II in England as a kid, and they wore gas masks. And that was his point of reference. And he still actually had, there was a picture of him as an older adult with his gas mask, he was holding his gas mask. And I thought, you know, this newspaper, The Commons, which prides itself as being part of the democratic process. If they're part of the democratic process, if they really truly believe they are, then they have to publish something on the contrary side. Mm-hmm. So I pressed the editor on that, and he did publish my article.
And it wasn't super radical. I mean, you were explaining how masks are used in a medical setting, what your training had taught you about N95s and whether surgical masks would work at all.
Yeah, and in the 1990s, when I was in school, in the early 90s, we were told that surgical masks are pretty useless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't even know if they're, yeah. They might cause more harm than good, is what the studies say.
Yeah, and N95s were meant only for use when you were suited up going into someone, to what was called a negative pressure room. It was a room where they were drawing air out of the room because somebody had a contagious disease. And you would suit up and put an N95 mask on. You also had a cap over your hair. Because, you know, I was walking in the suburban Boston recently, and I saw this woman outside at a mall wearing a mask, and she had this beautiful flowing hair, and I thought to myself, does she realize how many bugs are in her hair?
I know, right?
Really? I mean
they're not putting this in context at all.
Yeah, so... So I wrote this article about masks. And one of the things I want, you know, there was no research really to show this. But what I wanted to point out to people, especially with kids, it's about breathing rate. And it's about understanding that when we exhale, it's a very important process, not only does it relax us and it empowers us, but the out-breath is our means of letting carbon dioxide stream out of our bodies, shall we say, get rid of carbon dioxide. Too much is not a good thing. We need some carbon dioxide in our body. We're not trying to get rid of all of it, just enough. And we do that with our exhale. But when you cover up your face, where does the carbon dioxide go? Now, they were saying that there was so much confusion about the pores, the size of the pores of a mask. Can a bacteria get through it? Can a virus get through it?
I know.
It's like, my mind was going a little nuts with trying to visualize what this all means. But when you consider that a kid, a two-year-old, breathes 30 times a minute, that's their normal breathing rate.
Faster than an adult.
Faster than an adult. And then by the time they're four, maybe they're down to 20 times a minute. Maybe five, they're maybe still at 20. I don't know. But, it takes a while for kids to get down to the 12 to 20 that's normal. And actually, while we're talking about breathing rate, most Americans and probably most people in the world are breathing 30 times a minute.
Hmm.
12 to 20 is normal. And even 20 is high normal.
Wow.
And the reason I know this is because I watch people breathe.
Uh-huh.
And I count. You don't need a watch to do this. You simply count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, and you notice when they take the next breath. If they take the next breath at 3,000, and so that's 1,000 is 1 second. So if you count to 3,000 and they're taking another breath, you divide 3 into 60 seconds in a minute, and they're breathing 20 times a minute. It's pretty good. It's high normal. It's okay. If you get to 2,000 and they take another breath, you divide 2 into 60, and that's 30 times a minute. Whoa. You don't have time to get rid of carbon dioxide, and you also don't have an opportunity to inhale very long.
Right, for the blood to pass by and the hemoglobin.
For the air to get in. So, and it's high chest breathing. So wherever you have ribs is where you have lungs. But if you see the second button on your shirt moving, that second button is not over lungs, it's over your trachea, which is just a conducting airway. It's just how air gets down into your lungs, but there's no oxygen exchange. And so when you breathe shallowly, you can't exhale all the carbon dioxide, so you just keep pushing carbon dioxide down into your lungs and down into your lungs, and anyway, it's fruitless. So little kids should not be wearing masks. Kids should not be wearing masks. And people who breathe fast, obese people, and we know that 1/3 of our country people are obese.
Mm-hmm.
It's a horrible statistic, but it's the truth. And it's not your fault, perhaps, that you're obese. Our food system is promoting obesity. And our rules and regulations are promoting it. But you can do something about it. It doesn't mean you can't do something about it. So
love yourself regardless, or especially.
There we go back.
Especially.
Love yourself unconditionally.
Yeah.
Because if you're obese and you do not love yourself, unconditionally, you don't have the motivation to do what needs to be done. And I'll just say here, my thought on this is that obesity is not normal.
Mm-hmm.
We have taken it now to be normal. It is not normal.
Right. And the research, there has been research done on masks and obese healthcare workers, and there was a clear link that they suffered greater disadvantages, greater harms, and side effects of the CO2 poisoning and things.
And Amy Hornblass, who I'm talking to right now, is the author of a study, a Vermont mask study, totally documented that masks don't work and they're dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we won't find that out for maybe a generation when young people who wore masks have difficulties. And then we're going to have trouble even to say that masks are the reason for their disability, you know?
Exactly. And that's why I feel like right now we have this opportunity to kind of crack this nut wide open, you and me, because if people do go to my website, vtmasksurvey.com, VT like Vermont, masksurvey.com, you'll see, I think it's under the children's tab, I have a recent talk by Dr. Christina Parks, who is one of the frontline doctors who spoke out in the beginning about masks and different responses to COVID-19 and how they were actually dangerous. And she did a recent talk about masks, talked about children playing sports. We had children in our state of Vermont, healthy outdoor state, playing soccer outside with masks, playing basketball last winter with masks. And so she's livid about this. And she sort of insinuates about, you know, we can guess at what some of the long-term effects of this are going to be. But like you said, we're not going to see these for a long time. And I thought people might be interested because I was listening to a podcast with one of Bill Gates' favorite scientists the other day. And this one of Bill Gates' favorite scientists is named Nick Lane. And I encourage people to look up Nick Lane's work because he has studied oxygen and the effects on our longevity. Because, of course, people like Bill Gates, who have tons of wealth, you know, what would be one of their primary concerns is, well, I have all this wealth, but I want to live to enjoy it. You know, so I want to live as long as possible. So he's really interested in researchers like Nick who have been studying how do we prevent aging? How do we prevent disease? And Nick has discovered that oxygen, that healthy respiration, he totally agrees with you, Betsy. Healthy respiration is the key to health. That when we are deprived of oxygen, we develop, you know, aging diseases like cardiac problems, heart disease, cancer, dementia, and we begin to age. So I'm wondering, you know, knowing that we know that under these masks there is not enough oxygen, it's below the OSHA standards for a room. It is well above the CO2 standards, and I've been going around. We're such soul sisters because I've been going around with my bubbles, and some of my friends have been going around with bubble experiment to show school boards and other folks out there that you cannot even blow a bubble, like a bubble juice bubble with a wand. You cannot blow a bubble with a mask on. Even though you can blow a bubble so softly by hardly exhaling, you cannot get that much air out. And I've measured the CO2 in front of the mask. And when someone's wearing a mask, their CO2, it's not coming out. I can show you with the monitor. It's not escaping. And we know this. I mean, the research all agrees. Even the CDC's research agrees. And schools are masking kids again. Yes, they are.
And of course, winter is a terrible time for illnesses. I'm being facetious. But yeah, the masks have started to go on again in the grocery store especially. But you know, funny thing, I was reading The Commons one day. This was probably just even 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago. And the sports section had this beautiful picture of, I don't know, kids playing some sport, and none of them, they had masks, but they were all beneath their lip. Mm-hmm. The photographer had caught this, and the picture ran in the newspaper, and it was inadvertent, I'm sure, because I wrote a letter to the editor about how pictures speak louder than words.
Yes.
Of course, my letter did not get published, but I just thought it was so funny that the photographer caught this. The kids knew that they couldn't function with their mask on.
Right. Well, and when you see people just touching, you can tell that they want to remove it. Their body is trying, even if they believe in masks wholeheartedly, whenever their blood pressure raises, they get excited or, you know, whatever. They're having some sort of emotional response. You can tell they need more air, and they'll touch their mask. It's like they want to pull it down, but they stop themselves. And so children, I've seen videos, it's so heartbreaking, of babies and preschoolers and little kids, their parents trying to force these masks on them because they have to leave them at daycare and they have to wear the mask to go to school. And so you get into these battles, and it's just heartbreaking. So as a respiratory therapist, I mean, What do you think are going to be the health effects that maybe we may not see immediately of poor respiration? I mean, Nick Lane says, you know, you only get so many like chips in your basket of poor respiratory days in your life. And if you spend them faster, you're shortening your life. That's what Bill Gates' favorite scientist says.
Yeah. Well, what are the outcomes? Certainly mental illness. In fact,
interesting.
We were talking about the word dysphoria.
Dysmorphia.
Dysmorphia, which is a dislike of your body. That's sick. That is an illness. But it's an illness that we have brought on. Mm-hmm. And we've made it okay. Because, of course, masks are just...
a virtue.
Yeah, right. We're being facetious, I want to emphasize.
Right.
So certainly mental issues, self-acceptance issues. Who knows? Asthma. I mean, if you can't breathe effectively, you know, it's... our emotions affect our body. And asthma is a very emotional disease. When I was working for Millennium Respiratory Services, I visited a woman who had a paralyzed diaphragm. She needed what's called a cough machine. It's a machine that pushes air into your body and then it sucks it out. It simulates a cough. It's a very important machine for people who are unable to cough. A cough is a hugely vital function when you have mucus in your lungs that you need to get rid of, or anything, foreign object even in your lungs. And her diaphragm was paralyzed because she had been on steroids for asthma. This was a 50-year-old woman.
Hmm.
And she was having not only difficulty coughing, but breathing as well. But I asked her, so you've had asthma for 25 years. What happened 25 years ago?
Hmm.
And she thought about it, and she said, you know, I got married, and then I got divorced.
Wow.
And that's her asthma story. And she had never, nobody had ever asked her, and she had never considered, why did I get asthma?
Oh.
We get diseases for many reasons that are, some of them, psychologically based.
Mm-hmm.
I know someone who became diabetic. In fact, I know who became diabetic because she did not know how to get out of a teaching job. She was a young woman, and she was in this very stressful teaching job, and she loved the kids, but she didn't want to leave them, but it was taking its toll on her body. And then actually recently another person, a teacher, she was in Italy, I don't even know if she's still alive, during COVID, she could not, in Italy, she was taught English, she could not tolerate the restrictions that were placed on the kids in school and on herself. Masks and then sitting at your desk all day long and you couldn't move. There were lines drawn around desks and it was horrible.
Oh.
And she did not know what to do about it personally. She couldn't leave the kids. She couldn't quit and leave the kids. Well, her body spoke.
Right.
She came down with Lou Gehrig's disease, with ALS.
Mm-hmm.
This was a very fit woman. And this is how bodies respond.
To stress.
To stress, to emotions. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. So I am trying to be, you know, I really am conscious of that. And so when I am looking into the harms of masks, I try to bring in the humor. I try to bring in the harmony, the health, the well-being, the celebration of breathing. Because I don't want people to focus on what we know by biology could be the health effects, you know, because the more we focus and the more we stress. But I do worry because I see elders still wearing masks, especially thinking that they're protecting themselves. So people who are older, who have a slower respiratory, you know, their respiration is not as good anymore anyway. That's why Nick Lane says, you know, it causes all these...
Well, I want to challenge that, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. You learn the breathe-out dynamic system, and your breathing is going to be just fine.
Great.
In fact, I tell people who are using oxygen, in fact, I've one of the reasons I wrote the article in the Weston Price Journal about living, healing lungs after COVID is that
how can we heal lungs after COVID?
Is that so? We're often offered oxygen, and oxygen's a drug, and it needs to be used judiciously, and we're not being told how to use it or how to breathe effectively so that we don't need it so much. So learning the breathe out dynamic system, I've seen it increase saturation dramatically because it's efficient. So let's say you have some lung restriction with COVID. Your lungs may have gotten stiff, which means that the oxygen has more difficulty to getting into your bloodstream. Learning to breathe efficiently will give you an advantage so that you're not glued to your oxygen all the time and you can relax a bit. When I was doing pulmonary rehab, I had this woman, she was an ex-smoker, she was in her 60s. She loved to go to New York City. And she was carrying around an oxygen tank. This was before we even ever had oxygen concentrators. She had a nasal cannula and she carried a small E-cylinder, I think they're called. And I knew she didn't want to take it into the city with her. So one day she was on the treadmill on her oxygen, and I surreptitiously turned her oxygen concentrator, her oxygen tank off. And she kept walking on the treadmill. She had no idea what I'd done. And when she was finished, I asked her what her saturation was. And she said, oh, it's 96 or something. I said, you know, you did that without oxygen?
Wow.
I said, now you can go to New York without your oxygen tank with confidence.
Freedom.
That as long as you're focused on your out-breath most of the time, and the average person is not focused on their out-breath the majority of the time. Mm-hmm. It's when you're doing activities of daily living or you're walking or you're exercising that you want to do this. So you can bring yourself back from an injury by knowing how to breathe effectively.
Yes, and then of course we need the hemoglobin to be there. We need the nutrients, the iron, all of this
diet,
stuff, the diet, the water, which you talk about. I really encourage people to find more of Betsy's work. I know I have a lot of other questions. I have one last one, if I can sneak it in. We have maybe 5 minutes.
Okay.
Another concern about the masks are the particulates that people are breathing in. You know, these masks are made of materials. We don't know what. We're finding all kinds of things. I've heard the lungs are the biggest opening of the body. You know, OSHA speaks about this in their manual on mask use, how important it is to be very careful what we're breathing in. That's the point of masks in industrial settings. You were speaking about coughing. Is there a way for people who maybe have been breathing in some of these cotton fibers or who knows what into our lungs? What do we do about this problem we're going to be facing?
What do we do about this problem? Amy, you have opened up so many windows on the masking situation, really. What do we do about... Well, you know, detoxing is an important aspect of health. And I encourage listeners to learn about detoxing. What does it mean? We have every system in our body is a detox system. It's not just our bowels. Mm-hmm. It's our skin. It's our, of course, urine. It's our nose. It's tears in your eyes, wax in your ears. It's all helping us to detox. And drinking adequate water every day. Or, you know, actually I spoke to Sally Fallon, she's the founder and president of Weston Price Foundation, about how much water should we drink every day. I've heard 2 quarts. It's hard to know. And she said, you know what, I don't even really drink much water. I drink raw milk and I drink bone broth. Those are my 2 go-to liquids. So you can actually drink too much water and flush out a lot of good stuff. But, you know, you need to listen to your body. You need to keep records. Keep a journal of what you're doing. I keep a journal with this magnet therapy that I'm doing. I keep a journal so that I know what I've done, that I took an Epsom salt bath last night and it really helped my elimination or this or that or the other thing. Keep records and then go to your doctor with your records and say, look, this is what I've documented, that my oxygen saturation has been fine for this long. I would like you to authorize me to eliminate oxygen or whatever. Mm-hmm. Engage your doctor in getting you back to health. If they don't want to do it, find another doctor. Mm-hmm. Find someone. It may not be an MD. My chiropractor is my GP, my general practitioner, mm-hmm. and because he knows nutrition, and he's my go-to guy.
Fantastic. Wow. We have had, I think, a fabulous interview. I've been having fun, too. Oh, great.
I love sharing this. And I want to tell listeners that I give pro bono phone consults.
Wow.
Or if you want to set up a Zoom session, I would do that, but you have to set that up. In about a half an hour to 45 minutes, we can accomplish a great deal. The thing I request first is that you either read the book, especially chapter 3, or you go on the YouTube video on the website outbreathinstitute.com and start the process of learning the breathe out dynamic system. There is a learning curve. It could take you 2, 3, 4 weeks to learn this in your muscles. It's about your muscles. It's not about brain. It's about teaching your muscles to behave differently, and it requires practice. Then you can call me because you'll have some questions and I can help you through some rough spots.
Wow, you really care about people. I love that. Oh, thank you, Betsy Thomason. We have been speaking here today on the 4-H Show with Betsy Thomason, who is also known as the revolutionary respiratory therapist and breathing trainer. She is author of Just Breathe Out and director of the Outbreath Institute. And where can they find you again, your website, Betsy?
It's outbreathinstitute.com, or it's BZ as in zebra, Thomason, Thomason, @gmail.com.
Thank you for coming in, Betsy.
You're welcome, Amy. Pleasure to be here.
Yes, enjoy the great day, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
I'm used to